Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, La Florida, the interactive digital archive of the Americas.
You don't know what you're going to find until you start reading through them. We really hit a treasure trove with some of these documents.
We'll discuss the 1968 teacher strike,
the statewide walkout of 27,000 teachers on February 19, 1968, was the nation's first statewide teacher strike.
And we'll talk about Afrofuturism in historic Eatonville. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. La Florida, the interactive digital archive of the Americas, accessible online at laflorida.org, brings to life the diverse population of Spanish colonial Florida in St. Augustine. Amy Anderson is project manager for the La Florida Interactive Digital Archive.
We love Florida history, so our fundamental goal at the beginning was to be able to share the research in an interactive and accessible way. So accessibility is the project goal at its core, bringing the Florida past to the largest audience possible. And by doing that in an innovative way, combined with rigorous research, our hope is to increase the curiosity and interest about Florida's early history.
To create the different aspects of this digital archive, the La Florida team used records dating back to 1594. As Amy Anderson explains, the Lost Voices portion of the website was recently completed.
For this project, we utilized the entire collection of the St. Augustine Parish Archive. This archive is the oldest surviving parish archive in the United States, including Puerto Rico, with records dating back to 1594, like you said. The documents are sacramental documents in nature, which means they're baptisms, confirmations, marriages, and death and burial. The records are organized into 16 books and then 14 boxes, and by boxes, literal boxes with loose leaf pages in them that were not always in order. So that kept things interesting. So between those books and boxes, there's over 8,200 pages. And these documents are varying in condition. Some are worm eaten, water damaged. A couple are laminated from early preservation attempts. And of course, they're in varying languages. Majority are in Spanish. There's about 1,000 in Latin, because why not? And then a handful are in English. And they're also handwritten, obviously. And what we learned is every scribe is different. So we had various scribes keeping these records. And we do have a couple that are just gorgeous. I mean, aesthetically pleasing documents. We have a couple that are a little more difficult to read, to say the least. For this project, for Lost Voices, our time frame was 1594 to 1821. We thought the cutoff for Florida being transferred as a U.S. territory was a good place to stop. But the records do extend until about 1888. So if for some reason your passions extend past colonial Florida, we do have some stuff on the site in that area as well.
In 2012, the La Florida team was granted permission to transcribe and digitize the St. Augustine colonial era documents and make them accessible online. The next step was to find funding to translate the documents and make the translations available on the website.
So in 2019, we were ambitious and applied for a grant with the National Archives for $250,000. And spoiler alert, we won, which was wonderful. And with that grant and support from the Huff Family Foundation, the Lastinger Family Foundation, and Frankie Duckwall Foundation, we were able to start the next big phase, which was transcription and translation. We knew a brilliant paleographer based in Seville, Esther Gonzalez, who agreed to transcribe all 8,200 plus pages. And she ended up knowing Latin, which, you know, those pesky documents that I was complaining about, she was not only able to transcribe them for us, but she translated the Latin into Spanish, which really helped streamline our translation process. You know, with one transcriber, three translators, and then seven of us working on data registration, which was collecting all possible data points. You know, we had names, ages, races, familial connections, places of origin. Put it bluntly, we had over 30 spreadsheets, and some of those had over 250 columns, over 16,000 rows. You know, we wanted to extract every morsel of data from these documents to make sure we didn't miss anything. And then the final step was working with the wonderful tech team in Southern Spain, who showed us how to take our data, translate it into a language a database could read, and then migrate it so that it's in the format you see on the site today.
Other aspects of the LaFlorida.org website include short video presentations about selected residents of Spanish colonial Florida, an interactive map section, and a fun feature that allows users to transcribe email messages into colonial-era scripts. Amy Anderson says that the La Florida website is useful for historians, genealogists, and the general public.
We spent a lot of time talking about potential audiences for this project when we first began development. We decided we wanted to create a site that had appealed to the widest audience possible. You know, obviously we wanted students of Florida history and professional scholars, grad students, but, you know, we wanted genealogists. We wanted people that were interested in Florida, tourists. You know, you don't have to be getting a dissertation to get something from the site. We anticipate that everyone can find something that they like on the site. And then for the value, I mean, these parish records include biographical data for more than 70,000 people. This information includes all kinds of insight into the daily life of St. Augustine. You know, Ben, I'll tell you, a number of these individuals who appear in these records, this is the only time we see them in historical records. And, you know, I mentioned that there's baptisms, confirmation, marriage, death. There are some people that are born in St. Augustine, get confirmed, get married, and die. So we've got them all through the records. And it's almost like time traveling. You're following them on this amazing journey. So I think there's an amazing amount of value. These records show how diverse colonial Florida was. And again, I think a lot of people will get something out of it. Again, you don't have to be a professional scholar to get and learn something off of this site.
While collating, transcribing, translating, and digitizing these documents, Amy Anderson and the La Florida team were introduced to fascinating everyday people who lived in Spanish colonial St. Augustine.
One of my favorites just that's on there right now is Luisa de Abrego. And I don't want to spoil too much. I think people should definitely check out the site, but hers is a story. She's a free Black domestic servant who boards a ship from Seville to St. Augustine. It's about 1565. Once she's in Florida, she marries a blacksmith from Segovia, Miguel Rodriguez. First, this is the oldest documented Christian marriage in the continental U.S. So that on its own is incredible. The fact that it's between a free Black woman and essentially a Spanish conquistador making it an interracial marriage is incredible. So that document on its own was already outstanding. And then the fact that we found it in the Spanish Inquisition documents housed in Mexico City, where it becomes this bigamy case because she thinks she's got two husbands now. She doesn't know if her first marriage was legitimate or not. It's like peeling an onion. You can't get enough of it. So that was really incredible. And I think it shows the value of these documents. You don't know what you're going to find until you start reading through them. We really hit a treasure trove with some of these documents.
One of the most potentially useful aspects of the LaFlorida.org website is the digital visualization tool.
We call it the DVT, just because it's obviously a mouthful. Again, we wanted to make the information accessible. Early in our beta testing sessions, you know, we're working with a lot of content and you were learning a lot of stuff, but there were some points that you just wanted to directly ask a question. So we created the DVT for that very purpose. On the DVT, you can ask questions like how many men versus women were in St. Augustine during, you know, 1594 to 1821. And you'll get an infographic that shows you the data. And then what's nice, you start thinking of more questions to ask it after you get involved. And now, okay, how many of those men and women were enslaved? How many were free? And sometimes the answers are not what you expect. Like you think you know the demographic of Spanish Florida. And then you start playing with the filters and working on places of origin. And then you see that people from Scotland, Croatia, Welsh, Spanish Florida isn't just Spanish. So it's really interesting. And the DVT is a great way to kind of help show those infographics in a different way. And you're able to kind of play with it and start asking thought-provoking questions, really.
Amy Anderson is project manager for La Florida, the Interactive Digital Archive of the Americas, online at laflorida.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Registration is now open for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Florida State Genealogical Society Conference, being held May 18th through 20th in Lakeland. Just go to myfloridahistory.org for more information and to register. Amy Anderson from the La Florida Interactive Digital Archive of the Americas will be the keynote speaker. Other engaging presenters include Bob Keeling, author of the new book Good Day Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rocked Florida, Gary Mormino, author of the new book Dreams in the New Century, Instant Cities, Shattered Hopes, and Florida's Turning Point, Alonzo Felder, author of the book Discovering A.S.J. Allen, A Story of Skinfolk, Kinfolk, and Village Folk, and many others. There will be tours of the Frank Lloyd Wright architecture at Florida Southern College, visits to several local museums and archives, special musical performances, and much more. That's the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Florida State Genealogical Society Conference, May 18th through 20th in Lakeland. Registration is now open at myfloridahistory.org.
Solidarity forever.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, topics such as book banning and how history should be taught are being debated as political issues right now. Unfortunately, contentious debates about education are not new.
Most of us think about education and schools from the perspective of our own experiences as children. As adults, however, we know that education has been and still is a source of social and political friction. What will be taught, how it will be taught, who will be taught, and how education will be funded roil the public discourse continuously. Beginning with Reconstruction and continuing through the next century, Southern states fought to prevent the education of black and white children in the same classrooms. More than a matter of spatial proximity, the separation of children by race permitted a two-tiered public education that operated against black economic and social advancement in a world where education increasingly determined social and economic status. Although the U.S. Supreme Court ruled school segregation unconstitutional in 1954, Southern states delayed school integration until the late 1960s and early 1970s. Battles also broke out over the teaching of evolution and prayers in the classroom. Implementing educational standards for teachers proved to be a lengthy and contentious process. Books in libraries, school curriculum, the drawing of school district boundaries, consolidation of schools, and even school start times also prompted fierce public debate.
Now, Connie, the Florida Historical Quarterly has published some insightful articles about education.
Indeed, it has. As you would expect, most of the articles focus on school integration issues, but they often approach the history in unexpected and interesting ways. The Quarterly has published several articles on sports, race, and education. More recently, we have published articles on the long-term effects of the closing of schools in black communities and the impact of race in higher education. Recently, I was reminded of a prize-winning article we published that looks at Florida education as a labor issue, written by Jody Baxter Knoll, at that time a PhD candidate at Georgia State University. The article is titled, "We Are Not Hired Help, the 1968 Florida Teacher Strike and the Formation of Modern Florida." The statewide walkout of 27,000 teachers on February 19, 1968, was the nation's first statewide teacher strike. Although Florida schools were not yet integrated, Black educators and their union, the Florida State Teachers Association, joined white teachers and the Florida Education Association in the walkout. As Noel argues, the strike occurred at a pivotal moment in Florida's history. That is, the transition of the state from rural to urban political control and the implementation of a business efficiency model for government. The election of Republican Claude Kirk to the governorship in 1966 highlighted the transformative political potential. As Noel notes, Kirk recognized the importance of improvements in education to attracting jobs to the state. "Florida can't just live on sunshine," he said in a campaign speech. "To convince men with payrolls to come to Florida, I will tell them education is moving from 37th in the nation to first in the nation." In his centering of education, Kirk opened the door to public discourse on the state of Florida schools, a discourse in which the teachers' union and increasing teacher militancy would play an important role.
How did Kirk implement his plan to focus on education reform?
Kirk proposed to improve education by trimming the fat with no new funding and, importantly for him, no new taxes to pay for educational improvements. Noel summarized Kirk's position in this way. By viewing education as an investment in Florida's future, Kirk promoted the new conservative belief that an involved government could improve business climates. But his no new tax platform required him to push for tax efficiency-based reform rather than an increase in funding. While teachers supported the governor's call for educational improvement, they decidedly opposed the trim the fat approach. Decades of poor funding did not enamor them to the idea that more trimming would meet the needs. In May 1967, after voting to impose sanctions against the hiring of teachers from out of state and censuring Kirk and the state legislature, teachers met in Orlando and demanded a special session of the legislature to address education issues. Kirk responded with a 30-minute televised program in which he agreed to appoint a 30-member citizen panel to discuss the issues and make recommendations for the legislature. State leaders defended the teachers, pointing out that their concerns were for outdated textbooks, decrepit buildings, and lack of air conditioning, not salaries, as Kirk had claimed. Kirk capitulated and agreed to a special session of the state legislature in January 1968, hoping to avoid a walkout. When the Citizen Committee of Businessmen called for a tax increase to fund education, Kirk had the cover he needed. He agreed, but his plan provided for less than half of the increase to go for funding education. In addition, he planned to strip teachers of their autonomy and place businessmen in positions of administrative authority, replacing traditional educational administrators. Finally, increases in salary were to be based on merit, and teachers would lose continuing contracts. At the close of the special session on February 19th, the teachers walked out. The most active counties in the strike were Dade, Hillsborough, Pinellas, and Duval counties. But all counties participated except Taylor County.
Connie, the teacher strike was not entirely successful, but it did have an impact, right?
It did. Teachers found support and inspiration in other social movements of the period, including the civil rights movement. Indeed, the strike brought Black and white teachers together in what Noel characterized as a heightened social awareness. The strike had strong support from Florida's NAACP and Black newspapers in the state. The strike failed to garner similar support from whites, who fell back on demands for law and order. As Noel concludes, despite their best efforts, Florida teachers failed to convince a skeptical public that they had their children's best interests at heart. And Kirk effectively shifted the debate to one over union control within the state. Moreover, he used gendered language to imply that by striking, teachers who were predominantly women were abandoning their social role. Finally, the public perception of teaching as a low or non-skilled position enabled Kirk to hire unqualified substitutes and minimize disruption of class instruction. 3 weeks after the walkout began, it ended, with Kirk able to claim that he kept the schoolhouse doors open, making only minor concessions to the teachers. And yet, Noel claims that the strike shifted the ground for public service employees in important ways. In his words, the teachers were successful in staving off calls for merit pay and anti-tenure policies. Their battle against Kirk began as a call for improvements in Florida's education system, but it also became a battle over exactly how education would operate in the rapidly changing state. Most importantly, the teachers also forced the legislature to address the issue of public sector bargaining rights. The writing of a new Florida Constitution in 1968 provided a provision for public employees to have the right to collectively bargain, but not to strike. In 1969 and again in 1973, the Florida Supreme Court affirmed the collective bargaining rights. In making these gains, Noel asserts that the 1968 teacher strike transformed Florida into a modern state.
And yet the debates about education continue. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
Solidarity forever, for the Union makes us strong.
This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this look at the latest scholarship on Afrofuturism and the historic town of Eatonville.
Dr. Julian Chambliss is a professor of English with an appointment in history and the Val Berryman Curator of History at the MSU Museum at Michigan State University. His research interests focus on race, culture, and power in real and imagined urban spaces. In addition, he is the curator of the 2020 to 2024 Zora Festival Afrofuturism Academic Conference Cycle. I spoke with Dr. Chambliss mainly about curating this year's Zora Festival Afrofuturism Academic Conference that specifically focused on the theme of spirituality in Afrofuturism. Before discussing this year's specific conference theme, Dr. Chambliss provided a clear definition of Afrofuturism.
Afrofuturism is a cultural aesthetic movement that brings together elements of art, technology, and liberation to offer a kind of Afrocentric vision of the future. That definition kind of covers lots of variation of definition, but probably the easiest way to think about it is the intersection between speculation and liberation rooted in an African diasporic perspective that seeks to decolonize and promote a more equitable future. So technology is a very particular point in Afrofuturism because the term was coined in the 1990s and really is attached to the sort of transformation associated with Web 1.0. But because we're really talking about a practice of Black people speculating, really any moment in history since the age of discovery where Black people are speculating towards freedom can be considered Afrofuturism.
The significance of the theme of spirituality in this year's Zora Festival Afrofuturism Academic Conference is twofold. First, it is essential because it explains another crucial aspect of the overall field of study. Second, and more importantly, it has a pragmatic application. As Dr. Chambliss explained, spirituality is very much connected to the Black experience in Central Florida, specifically in Eatonville.
When we think about spirituality in Afrofuturist context, we're thinking both of a kind of spiritual practice, the things that we might think of as a religion, but we're also thinking about the rules about how the universe works, the cosmological framework that allow people to understand reality. And that's a really kind of expansive challenge. And so when I was thinking about this year, I was actually I think it's important. So I think about that, the idea, especially in the context of Central Florida and the Black experience, what does a kind of more redemptive, transformative moral space look like? And what are those legacies? On the one hand, obviously, Eatonville itself is a kind of moral project for Black people. They're using it to sort of affirm themselves, create a space where they're safe.
Despite the term Afrofuturism and its subsequent academic practice being created almost 100 years after the founding of Eatonville, those individuals were Afrofuturists at their core.
For the founders of Eatonville, they existed in a society rapidly becoming hostile to African-American aspirations towards citizenship and autonomy coming after the end of Reconstruction. And so the residents who founded the town were trying to create a space that would ensure their freedom, right? That would sustain themselves and their family and the future generations. And the creation of an all-Black town where they can own property, have businesses, educate their children, create a prosperity that can be handed down. They're doing that in opposition to a kind of relentless systemic erasure, right? Like that's pushing them out of the public sphere. No, we don't want you to vote. Is seeking to prevent them from having economic autonomy. No, we won't sell you land. Is trying to undermine their ability to educate themselves. Like, no, we don't want to fund Black education, or we're going to fund it very low. And they have to answer every one of these challenges through action. They have to figure out a way to acquire land. They have to figure out a way to educate. They got to figure out a way to have sustainable economic profile. And Eatonville is that for them. They partner with white allies, get the land, plat it out, put rules and regulations in place designed to keep it in Black hands and really sort of commit to a philosophy of community building and stability that they champion. And so therefore, you can easily see it as this sort of like intersection between speculation and liberation that I always talk about. These people are speculating what is necessary for us to be safe, what is necessary for us to be successful, what's necessary for our families in the future to be safe and successful. And they're like, yes, let's make a town. Let's incorporate that town. Let's keep that town a Black town. And that's an incredibly sort of like speculative exercise, right? Like they have to believe in the vision and sort of act on it.
As Dr. Chambliss pointed out, the practice of Afrofuturism was not limited to just the founding generation of Eatonville.
And that idea, I think, still motivates people in Eatonville even to this day. Like, you know, it's a Black town. And we can hear that in the parents' context and just sort of simplify the motivations behind that. But that idea of it is a Black town is really tied to a kind of counterpublic process of Black people asserting an ability to govern themselves, an ability to be economically and socially successful, an ability to sort of like provide for and promote the next generation into successful being.
With the recent decision of the Eatonville Town Council voting to preserve the site where once stood the first school for Black children in Central Florida, the Hungerford School, Afrofuturism and its thematic practice and application once again emboldened Black residents of Eatonville to take another step closer to a more liberatory and equitable future. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, an undergraduate history student and history podcast producer for the Department of History at the University of Central Florida. If you want to hear my podcast conversation with Dr. Chambliss about Afrofuturism and other fascinating work he does as an interdisciplinary scholar, follow my Twitter at @Seb_Garcia_ click the link in my bio, and tap episode 30 of Night's History Cast.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.